Right, good afternoon, everybody. My name's Simon Glendinning. I'm the Professor of European Philosophy in the European Institute here at the LSE and Director of the Forum for European Philosophy, which is one of the co-organisers of this event today on reconnecting Europe. And in a moment, I'll hand over to Luke Leuten from the Evans Foundation, which is our partner for this event and been very generously funding it, who will introduce our main welcomer. But for my part, let me welcome you to the LSE and for this event today. We've got three separate sessions, and I'm sure there'll be people coming in and going out for each, but you're absolutely welcome to stay throughout. The first one probably should have had a question mark on it, which is called Disintegrating Europe. It's not an assertion. It's something we want to explore. The second one on political economy in Europe, and the third one, final one, on European politics. And those three sessions map on to the central research areas of the European Institute here, and their teaching offering, in fact, our major master's degrees move through European society, European political economy, and European politics and government. And we wanted to, as it were, bring all those aspects of our own work to play in this event today to give a really strong overall conception of where Europe's at, and particularly over this very difficult question about the relationship between Europe's citizens and Europe's institutions, political institutions, particularly at a supranational level. So to introduce our welcome address, I'll now welcome here Luke Leuten, Chairman of the Evans Foundation.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear students, first of all, I want to thank the people of the London School of Economics for their enthusiasm when we introduced our idea for this cycle of conferences, and then for the efforts they put in organizing the event. Thank you very much. As you can observe, and I'm now talking this sentence to the students, I'm a little older than most of you. Just as you are today, I was once a student at university in the beginning in Belgium, in Ghent and Brussels. Just like you today, I was living the Greek life that students live, learning new things, developing competences, broadening my knowledge and my vision, meeting other students, and of course, partying now and then. However, there was one big difference. I was at the university in the late 60s. The month of May. That's wrong, sorry. The month of May in 68 was a particularly exciting time. Yes, we spent hours discussing social issues and the role of universities, and we marched in peaceful demonstrations to defend a better democracy. I'm sure you are familiar with the slogan that dates from that period, "Make love, not war." Over the past 60 years, with the exception of the Balkan War, there has been peace in Europe. Peace has prevailed for the most part, thanks to Europe. Europe learned its lessons from the past and turned the page. I fear that some countries, like Russia and Ukraine, did not turn the page. The event's foundation work and projects are concentrated in three fields: peace education, media education and media literacy, and Europe. Our motto is living harmoniously together in Europe. And Europe is the reason why we are here together. Europe shouldn't be at all about politics or revolution, but rather about tolerance. But tolerance doesn't mean indifference, or even worse, apathy. Nor does tolerance mean that we have to stop defending our very own European values. Europe shouldn't be all about limits or boundaries, but about respect and freedom, about solidarity and empathy. It's our responsibility to make it happen. That's why I would like to invite you all to participate in this conference with a May 68 spirit. It's you who can bring that spirit alive again. If we want things to work out well in and for the EU, it's clear that we cannot wait for others to get the job done. The central theme of the cycle of conferences, a cycle that aims to gather around 1,000 students in 5 European cities, and even more through live streaming and podcasts, it's how to bridge the gap between European citizens and European institutions. If the Evans Foundation has chosen this team to build this cycle around, it's definitely not because we think citizens and institutions in Europe are getting along perfectly. If we want to have a voice in Europe, we should be the ones who bridge the gap and not the ones who are impatiently waiting for those at the other side to reach out. If we want the foundations of Europe stay intact, we should defend them with commitment and passion. If we want our voice to be heard by European institutions and their representatives, we have to speak out loudly and with enthusiasm. We have to be optimistic and positive, creative and inspired. It's you who have the potential to raise your voices and to defend your important place in the European Union. It's you who have the dynamism and the creativity that it's needed to change things for the better. It's you who really can make it happen. And no doubt, instead of bridging a gap, you will soon be building bridges. Thank you all. Let me introduce the next speaker of today, and it's an honor for me to welcome Mr. Almunia Joachim, ex-vice president of the European Commission and commissioner responsible for competition.
Institute that has proposed me to be a visiting professor in practice of this university, I am very glad. to have in my new capacity the opportunity to address this extremely interesting conference. According to my experience as commissioner, member of the commission for more than 10 years, according to my experience as national politician during the previous 30 years or so, as member of government and the parliament in my country of origin, Spain, I had the opportunity to be part of the negotiation for the accession of my country to the European Union, then called the European Community. And in my previous professional experience, I worked on European issues. So I am a convinced pro-European for many reasons. And I am worried by the existence of the gap. So it's not a question mark. There is a gap. No, the gap exists, indeed. But I am also worried, and maybe I am even more worried as a Democrat, because the gap, it exists not only between the European citizens and the European institutions, but also in many of the European countries, in many of the member states of the European Union, this gap exists between citizens and democratic institutions in many countries. But let's talk today about the European Union, but don't forget that the gap, unfortunately, is broader than the relation between citizens and Brussels. In the European Union, since many years, there is a theory that can be shared to some extent, in my view, about the existence of a democratic deficit. It's true that as European citizens, we elect directly our representatives in the European Parliament, as we do in our European countries at the national level, in some countries as my own, also at the regional level, and of course at the local level. And even recognizing the existence of this democratic deficit perception, I have to say that during most of the years since the Treaty of Rome, since 1958, when the European integration process started, the political support for the European idea has been very high among the public opinion of most of our countries, if not from the six original members of the European Community in 58 until the 28 member states of today, plus the list of countries knocking at the door of the European Union, couldn't be explained if nobody wanted to be part of this union because there is no a democratic one. Many citizens will not knock at the door or support the politicians and the governments that were knocking at the door for the successive enlargements. But the democratic deficit had and have good reasons. Complexity of the European institutional framework, distance, different languages, the perception that there is no enough transparency in the way decisions are adopted. We know it, and this was compatible with a political support to the idea of integration. But now the crisis has changed the perception of many citizens. Even before the crisis, I remember in 2005, I was member of the European Commission, there was a constitutional treaty prepared by a convention with participation of national governments, national parliaments, and the European Parliament and the Commission, and two of the founders of the Union, France and the Netherlands, rejected in referendum the constitutional treaty. This was a wake-up call, a very powerful one. The crisis has widened. The malaise, the uneasy perception of what is going on and how Europe is not able to provide solutions or how Europe is giving solutions that are not supported by the majority of the citizens, but the majority of the public opinion. And this creates the adequate scenario for the rise of populism, of demagogical criticism. I can accept, of course, rational criticism. Many things needs to be criticized in the way our institutional framework work, but there is also a lot of demagogical criticism. This is the starting point. So we need to think how to provide the adequate answer, on the one hand, to the lack of political legitimacy or to the reduction of the political legitimacy of the European Union institutions vis-à-vis the public opinion. And on the other hand, we need to find a way to communicate solutions, not only to think about the solutions, but to communicate what kind of solutions the European responsibles, the European institutions, and the European leaders are thinking to cope with the problems. Let me say a few words about legitimacy. The EU integration is about sharing sovereignty. And indeed, there are good reasons to share sovereignty in some areas. In a global world, we need to use the European dimension to be united, coordinated, to be stronger and to provide more efficient solutions for our citizens. If not, we risk to become irrelevant in this world. But immediately, the proposal to share sovereignty, or the practice of sharing sovereignty and adopting decisions at the common level, at the European level, by sovereign nation states, provoke the reaction of nationalists and provoke a reaction of those who fear that sharing sovereignty, we will lose our identity. Second point, the distribution of tasks in Europe is not consistent, or fully consistent, with the model of society that the Europeans like more. We like what is called by someone the European social model, or welfare state, if you want. At different degrees, Europe, the European states, are a reference throughout the world on how to combine economic efficiency and social cohesion, how to provide protection to the weakest part of our society, how to provide public services accessible to everybody, how to increase the opportunities of the citizens. But the distribution of tasks produces a result that at the European level, the decisions that are adopted are not directly linked with these social results or social outcomes, even if decisions on the macroeconomic side or decisions on some structural policies on the supply side of our economies are a necessary condition for the success of redistribution strategies or for the success of social policies at the national level. But the perception is Europe is biased against social and is biased in favor of rigor, in favor of adjustments, in favor of the less popular decisions that a political responsible government or authority need to adopt. And this has, of course, increased during the crisis because when some countries in the euro area, but also beyond the euro area, requested financial support because they lost market access, the other member states providing financial support established conditions. And those conditions, adjustments, reforms, difficult decisions, had been adopted at the European level with everybody around the table, but for the implementation of these conditions, the authority, the European authority, the so-called Troika, appears as a watchdog, as a policeman that is not based on the political opinion of the country that is receiving these receipts and is obliged to comply with these reforms. And this mismatch has not been well managed. Now it seems that there are some corrections going on, but the perception regarding the social content of the European model of society is an imbalanced one, and more now after the crisis, or in this period of the crisis, than before the crisis. And third point, accountability doesn't work well. Were the Council decisions, the decisions adopted by the Member States at the European Council level or at the Eurogroup or at the ECOFIN Council level, are accountable for vis-à-vis the public opinion in Europe? The European Parliament cannot ask the European Council responsibilities. The European Parliament, elected directly with our votes, can ask responsibilities to the Commission. But every time that the decisions, as it's the case with macroeconomic issues and in particular with financial programs to assist countries in difficulties, every time that these decisions are adopted by Member States, deciding and discussing and deciding together at the Council level, the European Parliament, the representatives of the European citizens in a single Parliament, cannot ask for responsibilities. Are only the national parliaments to every one of the governments who can ask responsibilities, but the Greek parliament cannot ask, obviously, responsibilities to the German government, and the German parliament cannot ask responsibilities to the Greek government, to put the things in the two extremes. So there is a problem, the feeling that there is not only transparency, there is not only complexity, but there is also lack of accountability, lack of democratic control. So it is possible to solve these problems. It is possible to provide solution to these challenges so as to regain the support of the citizens and to reduce the distance of the gap, or to build bridges to fill the gap. I am convinced that it is possible, of course. I am convinced that national identity can be safeguarded even if we integrate our policies in different areas and we share sovereignty to solve in a more efficient way problems that cannot be solved anymore at the national level by a single nation state. It is possible that the welfare state of the 21st century, apart the reforms and the adaptations that are needed, can be organized according to the demands of the citizens, but only if the economic grounds for national governments to operate this development, this deepening, or these adaptations of welfare states are strong enough. If the economic grounds are weaker and weaker, neither a national government nor a European authority can solve the equation and can provide a strong welfare state, strong social cohesion policies, very good public services without a strong economic ground, economic base, economic functioning. So we need to combine this. And, of course, it's possible to further democratize the functioning of the European institution, increasing transparency, establishing a better link between the deliberations of national parliaments and the work of the European Parliament. And one important step forward was given a few months ago with the new way to elect the President of the European Commission based on the results of the European elections, a system that didn't exist before, and the European Commission had a president under the proposal in a secret deliberation of the head of state and government of the member states, not with the participation of the political forces, not discussing the ideas of the candidates in an electoral campaign, and not giving the Parliament the right to finally decide who will be the President of the European Commission. So we can improve, of course, and we must improve, because we cannot accept that a European idea will be wasted through a bad functioning of the democratic channels of the functioning of the European institutions, or through a bad link between the economic and social dimension of a political action that will create, as it is the case today, unfortunately, increased inequalities in our societies, and the feeling that the fairness of the social model in Europe is being wasted. But it's not easy. Can be done, of course, I'm convinced that can be done and will be done. It's not easy, and it's not easy for some reasons that I will just enumerate without further elaboration. First of all, the Parliament. We have a directly elected Parliament, of course, 750 members of the European Parliament, but we have 400 million voters, or almost 400 million voters in the EU. It's impossible, the direct contact. Maybe in some particular constituencies, the members of the European Parliament can try to have direct contacts, as you know here in this country and in many other countries, the direct contacts between the representatives elected by the voters and the voters that put the trust on these persons, on this party, on these leaders. The dimension, the proportion of the dimension, makes impossible to have a closer relation, a closer scrutiny of the personal attitude, the personal decisions, the personal tasks of members of the Parliament. On top of this, there is the problem of languages, the problem of the complexity of the issues discussed by the European Parliament, and is the problem that the European Parliament still has not been given some very important responsibilities, because member states try to keep in their hands at the council level some political decisions in the economic field or in the external affairs or in the security domain that citizens want to be submitted to a fully democratic decision-making process. National politicians doesn't help or don't help. And don't help because they are very often tempted to intermediate in the communication about what's going on, and the version in the different languages, in the different media, of what has been decided around the same table by the leaders or by the politicians is completely different. And finally, we still don't have real European-wide media. We have internet that can provide good solutions, but we don't have enough presence of European-wide media so as to give a coherent perception, a coherent transmission of what is going on at the EU level. Everything is possible, and I can conclude saying all these problems need to be solved. We need to tackle this problem. It's necessary to make the effort, because the alternative of a European Union without this gap, the alternative to bridge the gap, is an alternative that is more linked with the conflicts and the tensions that we had before in our history than with the future that we want to offer to the next generations. And this is my final optimistic conclusion to a rather pessimistic view on what is the present situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Almunia. Now, as I said, this next session that we're going to have now isn't about the reconnecting Europe without a question mark, given that we know that there is no question mark around there. But on a related theme, actually, towards the end of the Mr. Almunia's address, he noted that if issues around Europe's condition at present aren't resolved, we'll be looking back to problems of previous centuries that had absolutely bedeviled Europe. And in part, what I hope we're going to look at in this first session are some of the strains pulling on Europe today from those kinds of legacies, not only historical legacies of the nation, which I think John Brulé may address some of those issues, but also the new global environment that you also mentioned, Mr. Almunia, about Europe in a globalised world. It's not just about resolving issues in its own space, and the power of governments or the lack of power of national governments to be effective in these new global conditions. So we have these two tensions, one from the old nations, another from a new global economy, making new demands on a very new institution, putting pressure on it in various ways, to which internally somehow it will need to respond. But what I want to invite our speakers to do is to give us some of the framework from their point of view on these sorts of tensions. And we'll first have an overview from John Brulé, who's the Professor of Nationalism and Ethnicity here at the LSE, and then followed up by Kalypso Nikolaides, who's Professor of International Relations and Director of the European Studies Centre at the University of Oxford. And she's just published a new book called Echoes of Empire, which is precisely about this sort of way in which our past still inhabits our current conditions, and that responding to our new situation is also about inheriting those legacies and responding to them. So I'm very grateful to them both, and John, perhaps I'll ask you to go first. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm an historian, so I'm not going to talk about the present, let alone the future, but more about the past and how it shows how difficult it is to talk about the present and the future. I notice in the title for this session, Disintegrating Europe, Nationalism, Regionalism and Globalisation, and then the little blurb is, at the level of both the member states and the EU as a whole, there are social forces pulling in opposite directions, both local and global, putting tremendous pressure on existing political institutions. This session will explore the cultural and political conditions prevailing in Europe today. Well, I'm not going to do that latter bit. But I want to begin with these key words, disintegrating, Europe, nationalism, regionalism, globalisation, and in the introduction, member states, European Union, local, global, Europe. Can one construct some implied set of assumptions here? I think one can. The implications are that there is something, either real or sought, called European unity, and it's threatened. And it's threatened by nationalism. Let's say that that is the egoism of the nation state or some people within the nation state, which would be the member states, because by and large we take the member states of the EU to be nation states, plus potential member states, the ones who are engaged in possible accession talks. Let's by regionalism assume we mean separatist or other kinds of movements within nation states. So in a sense, they bear the relationship to nation states that the nationalism of nation states bears to the idea of Europe. And let's take globalisation to mean some kinds of forces that are beyond in European EU control. And let's also take it, because we've got this very strong word, disintegrating, that especially virulent are combinations of these forces. Nationalism, for example, as irredentism, regionalism as secessionism, and particularly when combined in the form of irredentism and secessionism, for example, in the eastern Ukraine at the moment, particularly disintegrating forces. And I think finally, there is this sense that the nationalism and to some extent the secessionism that constitute one threat are what I would call ethno-nationalism. That is, it's nationalism which frames the idea of the nation in terms of a particular community of blood or language or religion or something in the sense that people don't really have choices about. And I think in terms of globalization, perhaps a term that many people might think of as particularly to do with the threat is now called neoliberalism. The idea that somehow, for example, to come to the point that we made in the previous talk about social cohesion and so on, that one doesn't need to think too much about that, providing the market works properly, that in a sense will provide the kinds of solidarities we need. Now, I don't want to question the way of framing these issues, I just want to suggest that in a way these key words suggest that way of framing it. What I want to do as an historian is to suggest that all these words are relatively new in their meanings, and that we need, in a sense, to take on board the implications of the fact that these words are new, and that these words, or words like them, actually had different meanings in the past. And the danger, I think, as an historian, I think one of the, insofar as historians can be useful citizens, no doubt, but nevertheless, insofar as they can be, it's to talk about the fact that we mustn't project back the terms that we now find natural into the past and then project it back into our present. So my basic argument, insofar as I've got an argument, is that the European project is as new as the problems that are said to beset it. In other words, it doesn't precede these problems. It is part and parcel of this problematic. The ways we understand terms such as nationalism, nation-state, Europe and globalisation are also, I think, rather new and not the way they would be understood in the past. So let me just take us back a little over a century to round about Europe circa 1900. The key political unit was not the nation state. The key political unit was the national imperial state. It might have a national core, but it only made sense in terms of the powerful states, in terms of an imperial penumbra. There were two basic forms of this national imperial state. One was the continental dynastic state, Romanov, Habsburg, Ottoman. The second was the global imperial liberal or authoritarian state, Britain, France, Holland, Belgium, Portugal, Spain. With the important, impossible to place, exceptional case of imperial Germany. And it's important that it is difficult to place it in either of those two categories. These states were legitimised not in ethno-national terms. They were legitimised either in traditional dynastic and or religious terms, or in broader terms than ethno-national terms. Civilization, culture, particularly Kultur with a capital K in the German case, and race. Race was a very important consideration, but race is not the same as ethnicity. Race is a much broader category than ethnicity. Insofar as distinctions between different kinds of nation-states were made, they were not made in terms of ethnic characteristics. They were made in terms of culture, civilization, institutions. For example, a distinguished historian, a German historian at the time, a man called Friedrich Meinecke, made a distinction between what he called Staatsnation and Kulturnation, state-nation, culture-nation. And he distinguished between France and Germany on that basis. But what he meant was not by culture ethnic, he meant that in a way a German culture had preceded the formation of a German nation state, whereas in the French case he thought a French nation state had preceded the construction of a French culture. The assumption was that history was on the side of the big divisions, that if one or other imperial state fell, it would be replaced by some other imperial state. The assumption is what we now call ethno-nationalism or cultural nationalism or small nation nationalism had no future. It might operate as a cultural movement within bigger states, and this was an assumption that even the enthusiasts for these movements themselves shared. Czech nationalists, people we call Czech nationalists, for example, never expected before 1914 to have an independent Czech or Czechoslovak state. They expected to have some greater cultural autonomy within an empire. Then came, and this is what history is always doing to people, it's completely disrupting all the assumptions that you have, then came the First World War. The dynastic empires, the first kind of empire I talked about, collapsed. But they were not replaced, as one might have thought was the norm in a world of imperial states, by an extension of the formal imperial power of the victors. Instead, we got a novel idea. From the West, from the new dominant state in the West, from the USA, from Woodrow Wilson, we got the idea of national self-determination. From the East, from the Bolshevik Revolution, from Lenin, and from the Commissar for Nationalities, one Stalin, we got the idea of national liberation. And in both of these cases, the ethnic model, language, or other kinds of narrow conceptions were used as the basis for trying to understand what the boundaries of these nation states should be. So in a way, the idea of the nation state, as I think we nowadays think of it, was almost invented, I think one could say, after the First World War, to solve a particular problem in one particular part of the world, Central Europe. But even then, it wasn't seen as self-sufficient. First of all, in realistic terms, it was thought that the major victors had to guarantee this. And secondly, that there would be global organisations, in a sense perhaps predecessors of the European Union, which would also coordinate. The League of Nations was the Western idea, the Communist International was the Eastern idea. It's now that we get the conception of nationalism and the nation state as ethnic. For example, German historians who've been pupils of Meinecke said Meinecke's double characteristic between state and culture, you had to add a third, ethnos. But as Germans with particular interest in East Europe, they thought this ethnos was an unviable proposition. These new small states not only shattered German dominance in Central Europe, but wouldn't last. There had been other more limited projects, what we might see as the germinations of a European project. The young Jean Monnet, for example, was involved in trying to get the British and the French to cooperate much more effectively in their war efforts during the period of the First World War. But by and large, those failed. Ethno-nationalism then reared its ugly head in virulent ways in the interwar period, but always within a much more ambitious global framework, particularly that of communism or fascism and race imperialism, in which there is no space for a concept of a Europe of nation states. The Second World War, of course, saw the destruction of the fascist, racist, imperialist threat. But meanwhile, it also saw a massive, what we now call, ethnic cleansing. The formation of much more ethnically homogenous nation states. One looks at the ethnic composition, say, of Poland in the interwar period and then after the Second World War, and there's been a huge change. There's a rerun of the League of Nations idea in the form of the United Nations, but there's major difference. Now we have a bipolar world of two blocks in which Europe is split down the middle. Second, we have the official refusal to recognise ethno-nationalism. Optimistically, this is partly to do with a repudiation of what fascism stood for. In part, it was a reaction against what was seen as the mistakes made after the First World War in allowing groups to be classified in terms of national majorities, national minorities, and so on. So the idea was that one wouldn't, in a sense, talk about national minorities and national majorities in this new era. But in part, it was because of the very ethnic cleansing process, which meant that one could ignore, to some extent, the issue of ethnic tensions, because, in a way, the ethnic tensions had been brutally solved. It was also the end of the national imperial state, so far as Europe was concerned. The key losses come almost immediately after the war. Britain loses India. Holland loses the East Indies, Indonesia, and France is already on the back foot in Indochina. The other imperial possessions are really rather less important, and they have to be constantly shared, above all, with the United States of America. And here, I think, is where one sees the origins of the European project. We heard in the opening speech about how Europe learned the lessons of that 30 years' war period, if you like. Except that this European project has two European projects. You could say Stalin had a European project. Stalin was the first person to float the idea seriously of German reunification, for example. But we tend to think of it as confined to Western Europe. In the first instance, to those countries that had been doubly occupied. Occupied first by conquerors and then by liberators. Plus, of course, the Federal Republic of Germany. I think there are two key components in this. This is gross historical generalisation. One was economic rebuilding. That was obviously a key consideration. Alan Millwood wrote a very interesting book about the formation of the European community called The Rescue of the European Nation State. In other words, he saw this principally in terms of nation state problems. Although there were visionary characters, what Millwood rather satirically called the European saints, like Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman, he saw, for example, the key early decision was the iron and steel community to do with the fact that if France was to have an economic recovery, she had to have access to German coal resources. And this idea of Europeanising resources rather than pillaging Germany, that would be the post-1918 solution, which was not simply going to be allowed this time round, was how to do this. But the second, and I think it addresses the second talk, was it was to be done by elite methods. It was elites who were to think this through. These elites were very suspicious of democratic politics. This democratic politics had given rise to communism, it had given rise to fascism, it had given rise to populations who for some time now had not been involved in political decision-making. So in a way, I think part of the problems to do with the European project is the fact that it had its origins in this narrow West European project. It has had its origins, one, in focusing on economic rebuilding, and two, to do so in a sense in a fairly expert, technocratic way. But I would argue that the third key component, stretching well beyond these early European cooperation efforts, way beyond the six original countries, the real way in which the nation state was integrated was not through ethnic identity at all. It was through precisely this social cohesion. It was through the construction not just of economic recovery, but the welfare state. And it was based, I would argue, on two positive political forces. Social democracy on the one hand, and what one might loosely call Christian democracy on the other. And that in turn was based on two key social constituencies. Organised labour on the one hand, and what we might call a professional middle class. A middle class that felt a responsibility over and beyond its own narrow employment prospects. And there was also the stimulus of the Soviet threat. That if one didn't satisfy mass desire for some kinds of social security internally, the Soviet threat, which seemed a very economically credible threat in the 1950s, would provide something different. There was a typical progressive development of this through the 1950s and 60s. In a way, it established the norm of how we think of the European Union eventually working. Nation states engage in different kinds of cooperation under two different kinds of hegemons. But then came the breakdown. In the 1970s, first of all, the nature of US domination changed, particularly with the freeing of exchange rates, with the oil price hike, with political polarization by the end of the 1970s and into the early 1980s. The questioning of this social and Christian democratic consensus, the election of more radical right leaders in the USA and the UK, Ronald Reagan, Mrs. Thatcher, the rise of the neoliberal alternative, and at the same time the rise of separatist movements. And to this was added, completely unexpectedly, just a few years later, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the East European Communist bloc. Genuine sovereignty for the Warsaw Pact states, violent dismemberment of Yugoslavia into ethno-national components, a more peaceful dismemberment of the Soviet Union in the same way. This is when we hear the rhetoric of the end of history, of the common European home, a phrase used by Willy Brandt, but also by Gorbachev. Of course, it didn't work out like that. But with the economic crisis and the failure of neoliberalism, first in the East, which saw the rise of Putin, and then in the West, particularly from 2008, in a sense, I would argue, we had burnt some of the earlier boats that constructed solidarity to do, for example, with those political constituencies of social democracy and Christian democracy. We also gave a new meaning to the idea of Europe, because now the idea of Europe could be expanded geographically as well as institutionally. The 28 states now include many states from the former communist bloc. But of course, these were very different states with very different social and economic and political experiences from the states in which a more gradual process of extension had been going on before. We see the erosion of welfare and cross-class solidarity. We see the deprofessionalisation of that middle class. We see the diminution of the power of organised labour. And I would argue that, in a sense, one of the things that goes along with this is a retreat into a narrow concept of nationalism, the concept of ethno-nationalism. The new key word becomes identity. Everybody worries about identity, preserve our national identity, what is our European identity, and so on. In other words, not just ethnic identity, but identity in other ways. And even when other terms are used, they are actually used in identity terms. I think today, the way we talk about British values. Turns out the values are not specifically British. I don't see that tolerance is an especially British value. But by calling it British value, in a sense, you make the identity aspect of it, rather than, in a sense, the value aspect of it. Or if you say, as some of the far right have recently done, that it's Islam which is the source of problems, not Muslims, you have shifted the argument from an ethnic argument to an apparently non-ethnic argument, but you've essentialised the identity argument. But what I would argue is that broad conceptions, whether they're national or supranational, are not based on conceptions of identity. Identity, if you like, is the product of the ways in which we cooperate with one another. They are not the causes of the ways in which we cooperate with one another. We had those broader conceptions of culture, civilization, but also, in an ugly term, race, backed by powerful social forces embodied in institutions. Now, this has been rather pessimistic because the words used at the beginning of this drew our attention to things like disintegration and nationalism and so on. So I've, in a sense, in a very selective way, focused on some of the things that you could see as the problems. I've overstated and exaggerated their significance. I'm not quite as optimistic as the previous speaker, but I'm not quite as pessimistic as what I've been talking about might suggest. But nevertheless, I think this should lead us to question the ways in which we talk about the European project today, to question constantly talking about identity and how do we foster identity, but instead to talk about institutional solutions, to talk about the ways in which certain kinds of social solidarity might be practiced in just very practical ways, different kinds of welfare schemes and so on. And finally, and there's no answer to this, as an historian, what I constantly become aware of is that all the assumptions we make rapidly have to get torn up and reconfigured because everything gets smashed out of sight. 1914, 1917, 1919, 1939, 1940, up until then France was the most powerful Western European state. 1 month later, it wasn't and never was again. 1941, 1945, the Cold War, the end of empire, the end of economic growth and solidarity, the end of the USSR. At each point, a lot of the assumptions and terms that we'd used to understand our world became redundant, and we had to construct a set of new terms. And every time we construct a set of new terms, we think, those are the terms that'll work. Until the next time. Thank you.
No, I'm a philosopher, and gross historical generalisation just sounds like brilliant to me. I wish I could just listen to it all day. But we are going to move on swiftly to Calypso. Is that good? All right. Okay, so thank you very much.
Hello, can you hear me? I better have the microphone, because, you know, yesterday I was walking in Montreal Airport feeling very sorry for myself and almost having to cancel for lack of voice today with my very big cold. But, thankfully, I walked by panels of HSBC. Now, I know it's very politically incorrect to praise HSBC these days, but I was also feeling sorry for my long-suffering Greece. And here they had, in the future, we will quench our thirst with salt water. We will be planting city. There will be no difference between waste and energy, and the smallest business will be multinational, and all this. And I felt to myself, you know what? I want the future to be now, this future, their future, especially for my Greece. And it suddenly made me optimistic and made me want to speak to you today in this rather optimistic way in which we can imagine a future that is anchored in the present. So, indeed, that's what I would like to do. And in that, you will see that I will echo many of John's themes. Because, yes, Luke started us off by stating, how do I move this? Where? Oh, there, here. That we live harmoniously together. John, the slides are important.
Oh, I'll move.
Or else you won't understand what I'm talking about. But it doesn't feel like it, does it, Luke, these days, that we live harmoniously together? And indeed, the crisis that has beset us 5 years ago and started from this tiny little country, Europe, has started all sorts of fires and responses to the fires. And the latest installment of this story is, of course, what we saw in Athens, the Syriza vote. And I'd like to end today by trying to say, you know, how do we reread and understand what's happening in Europe today through the prism of this saga of Syriza, because some of you might be interested. But in the meanwhile, we've been asked today to talk about disintegration. And the question is, you know, we all have different ways of reading disintegration and integration and these dynamics. Indeed, Europe, as John made it very clear right now, there are many stories about Europe. We each have our different ways of talking Europe. A few years ago, I committed a book called European Stories that was exactly that, how in different countries we have different debates and disagreements. They may echo each other, but they're nevertheless fundamental different because they have different traditions, ideas of progress, etc. So today, I'm going to give you my reading from the way I tell the story these days. I interpret the European project and how it's led us to this crisis. And indeed, I want to start with you where John got us by World War II and what was happening then. Now, we like to ask at that moment, you know, what did European states want to do? Well, they wanted to move from the land of anarchy, sovereign states and competing empires, and sometimes both together, as John was stating. And the question that they asked themselves is, should we move to the land of unity and create a federal state? And there was a federal union and The Hague and all that. But in Europe, we'd only known the land of unity through imperial peaces, pacification rather than peace. And what we really see when we look at the post-war history is that this is not what Europeans decided to do. They didn't decide to go on a linear journey from the land of unity to the land of anarchy to the land of unity. Instead, there was a Rubicon. And this Rubicon, that's my story, they decided not to cross. Not to cross the Rubicon to the land of unity. Instead, they had this debate. You know, we had the sovereignists. Yes, we need to uphold the traditional state system. And the radical federalists. No. Nationalism is bad. We need to transcend the state system. And if you analyze these years until 57, what you see is that the decision, it's sometimes labeled as the moderate federalist, but the decision was to transform the system of European state. It was not to transcend it, but to transform it through this union to be. And so my story is that the European Union, EC at the time, is a story of how and whether and to what extent these member states and their elites, and eventually their peoples, managed to navigate this Rubicon and managed to escape what one can call the mimetic logic, the logic that when you decide to integrate and cooperate would take you from the nation state to EU statism. Mimetic because it's the same political form, you just reproduce it at a different level. And instead, to embark in a transformative logic. And so, on this Rubicon, the point is to stay in spite of all sorts of shocks. And as history, at the wheel of history turns, as John just said, history always brings us new surprises and new circumstances. But nevertheless, this transformative dynamic in Europe was based on what I like to call the transformative wheel. That in each of these realms up here, and I'm going to take you through every one of them, there was a transformative logic that was about staying on this Rubicon. Now, I'll come back to the transformative wheel in a minute, but let me make two preliminaries before I do so. The first is that on this Rubicon of ours in the European project, there was what one may call a normative compass. And the normative compass, by this I mean not some sort of deductive, Rawlsian, pre-existing, ideal, typical thing. No. By this I mean a compass that came from European history itself. What had the war taught us? What had the terrible 20th century and its prehistory told us? That the plague of Europe was domination, one state trying to dominate the other. So Europe was going to be about non-domination. Non-domination by one state of others, especially smaller state, from the Bismarcks to the Napoleons and Hitlers of this world, but also vertical non-domination, non-domination by some center. That was fundamental. But the dynamic of the system was also going to come from another fundamental principle. So one principle was transnational non-domination, still with us today. And the second is transnational mutual recognition. The idea that what was war all about, aside from the will to dominate and subjugate, it was the denial of recognition of the identity and right to exist of other people. It's not for nothing that there was as many deaths after 45 in every neighborhood of East and Southeast Europe and elsewhere than during the war, because one was still wanting to kill one's neighbor. Mazower has a beautiful book on it. So denial of recognition was at the core of the tragedy of Europe, and transnational mutual recognition to this day is or ought to be its motto. So according to me, there is an imminent critique. There's an imminent set of two norms that should guide the European project and that indeed guided it at its beginning. I've written a lot about this if anyone is interested. But the point is, this is what moved us on the Rubicon forward. And these two principles, as we can discuss, can be translated very concretely. They're not just abstract. But the second point about the Rubicon and being on the Rubicon is that, of course, they're globalization force. We're not a little closed world, as John was saying a minute ago, and Joachim too. And what happens when there are globalization forces? Well, that's the little description of our session. We have forces of fusion and forces of fission. Forces of fission, yes. And we are in Britain. You know, Britain, sometimes many in this country say, yeah, it would be better to be on our own than on as a union. You know, when there are storms on the Rubicon, you want to go back to the dry land. It's much easier to construct and to hang on to the construct of the autonomous sovereign state that vaguely collaborates with others. But of course, there is the opposite temptation, that of fusion, very much incarnated by Germany, who wants to say, please protect us against our demons. We, Germany, we don't want to control others. We want Europe to be one and us to be among those who make it one in the dry land of unity. Let's not be on this Rubicon. Let's have a federal Europe, and we'd be better off this way. So my question is that, well, I value the fact that we are, as the European project, on this Rubicon, this funny river that we cannot cross, but that we want to stay a project, which is a federal union and not a federal state. A funny political project that doesn't become a state as its member states cooperate. And to me, that is a precious equilibrium because it's one that does all sorts of things for us and certainly makes sure that we don't have a tyranny of the majorities, that we have autonomy, that we have local and citizen ownership and all of that. So it is a precious equilibrium. But what has happened today with the crisis is that globalization has entered the European space through shaking up the Euro construct that was one element of this project. And it is the way in which globalization shook the European construct, which in turn has created this double pull and push, these forces of fusion and fission. So that allows me then to come back to my... So the question becomes for us, what happens with the transformative wheel then, as we are in crisis today? And does it mean that we are in an unstable equilibrium? Does it mean that Europe will disintegrate? So let me take it step by step. What happens to the state in this story? After all, as John reminded us, the very core of Europe is the construct of the state. In fact, we exported this construct throughout the world in the 19th century. And of course, globalization affects all states in the world. But the less vulnerable they are, the more globalized these states are, constructed to be protected against globalization, the better. And what was the EU all about? It was about saying, well, we will help our member states deal well with globalization. That was kind of the idea. That was one of the ways in which citizens bought Europe. Europe helps us in a globalized world. So MU and its crisis, the greatest turning point from that viewpoint is that this machine that was supposed to help us deal with globalization is now a magnifier of its pathologies. The EU magnifies the pathologies of globalization, summarized as casino global finance. That's how citizens perceive it, but isn't it true too? Citizens are not always wrong. Now, at the origin, of course, the European project was, yes, about taming nationalism through elements of supranationalist constraint, but as John was saying, it was about the rescue of the nation state too. And indeed, it's so important to insist on this point, lest we forget that resistance during the war from which the European project emerged was maybe against nationalism, but in the name of the nation state. You were in the Belgian resistance, the French resistance, the Greek resistance. And so it is this respect and taming of the nation state together, this informal, this balance that is at stake with the European project. And as the decades went by, many have written about the transformation of the state through the European project. What happened? The state got transformed. The likes of colleagues like Chris Bickerton would say, well, you know, you can summarize this story by saying we went from the nation state to the member state. That's how the state was transformed. That's not entirely true. On my part, I would say that we went to a construct where we will have states that are both member states with everything that is implied by that, all the common governance and all that, but still nation state in terms of the fundamental anchoring of the identity of its citizens. So in a way, the state today in Europe is not tout à fait le même, not tout à fait un autre. And what has happened with the Euro crisis is that, of course, We've seen the EU, even before, acquiring more state, so-called core state powers, those of the state of the 19th century, money, elements of defense, even bits of taxation. But the European Union, nevertheless, has not become a state, even a decentralized mini-state, in the process of acquiring some of these core state power. Why? Because the exercise of these powers in the EU remains two things. Fundamentally mediated. We don't have tax collectors in the street of Athens from Brussels. That we know that the EU state functions are still exercised by the member states. And moreover, the state functions exercised by Brussels, as Joachim can tell you, is Joachim still here? No, he's left. Are very much about horizontal obligations, what states ought to do vis-à-vis one another, rather than centralization. But we could come back to that. So the question that is posed with the euro crisis is whether we will stay in this kind of balanced, non-state-like aggregation of state powers, or whether there will be the temptation to make Europe much more like itself a state. Now, the second element in the transformative wheel is that of regions. And, of course, it's in our title, so I thought it would be important to talk about regions. Because, definitely, if the spectrum haunts Europe, that of disintegration, we talked a lot about this at the time of the Scottish referendum. And, indeed, it was no longer... The question was, how would this relate to the Grexit and the Brexit of this world? And you had EU officials going around saying that, well, hey, if Scotland gets out of Britain, it will also be out of, it will mean a no to the EU too. And why were the EU, so there again, I would say there was a risk of this kind of attitude breaking a certain equilibrium in Europe. Because you may disagree, you may believe that secessionist movements are against the very nature of a Europe which is indeed about togetherness rather than separation. But it is interesting that Europe has used legal arguments to say make divorce within nation states in Europe is not legal. It's not possible. We can't do it. Well, true, you know, nation states and European nation states don't have prenups. You know, they don't have in their constitution a story about how we're going to divorce. But does it mean that they can't? Well, we know that no prenups doesn't keep you from no divorce. But the EU traditionally has always said, we're not going to intervene in our member states' affair. We're not going to intervene in the Northern Irish problem. You know, we intervene around the world as peacekeepers for much less than what happened in Northern Ireland. But we have, interestingly, in spite of all our talk about shared sovereignty, we don't intervene in Europe in that sense. And indeed, Europe, the EU since the beginning, has said yes to regions. Regions are part of the European project, except if they want to get out and become member states and change their identity and status in the European Union. Now, it's completely false that under international law you can't just get out of an organization. You can, and in fact it happens, and you stay a member under a different status if a region separates or secedes. And the EU would have very easy way of bringing back a region that secedes in through various ways. One of them is internal enlargement and Article 48, etc. I'll spare you the detail. But of course, we know that the story there is of a Europe that supports its member states who fear secession, the precedent problem, the Catalonia problem. And indeed, what Scotland responded is that Europe has always expanded membership, not retreated membership. Of course, that's not entirely true. Europe not lost Greenland, Europe lost Algeria, who remembers? But it is generally true. And so the question becomes whether the way we deal with region and the possible potential disintegration of certain nation states or secession in certain nation state, will respect the very basic principle of Europe, which is choice. The point here is, if a region seceded from a member state in Europe, the very fundamental principle of Europe and of the EU is that it should be that one choice of leaving, say, Spain or Britain, should not lead to another implicit choice leaving the EU. That choice should be made by the country itself, the region itself. And after all, as John reminded us, the story of modern Europe has been that of the creation of smaller nation states out of empires who, after terrible twists and turns, learned to better live together as neighbors than they used to live together under one big roof as empires. So if we start seeing regional self-determination, that may be congruent with a world where democratic progress is related to decentralization, localism, and interconnectedness of independent units. And that means that should in the British Isle or anywhere else we find new constitutional settlement, this is very compatible with the spirit of the EU as it is today. It's not a story of disintegration. It's a different kind of settlement. And some would argue that, you know, there's been economist studies that show that actually in today's world, globalized world, you're better off if you're about 5, 6, 7 million. Singapore is better off than, say, France. And I'm not arguing for secession. I personally, you know, was in for Devo Max. We're looking at very interestedly in what is happening in Scotland today and Catalonia and the rest. But let's not look at regionalism as a mode of disintegration. Okay, so that's for regions. Now, which brings us directly then to power. Now, as I said at the beginning, the EU with non-domination was all about the taming of power. The EU is a post-imperial project, and that's what its institutions reflect. It's all about equality between member states, you know, the rotating presidency and the commissioners and all that. Tiny Malta has disproportionately more power than its size would dictate, right? Right? Well, not quite, is it? That's what we call formal equality in Europe. But hey, not all member states are created equal in Europe. We know this. Sorry. So the question really when we look at power in Europe, of course, like any polity, the European Union recognizes asymmetries of powers. That's what it's all about. But the question is whether asymmetries of power are reflected in direct asymmetries of influence, or whether they are channeled in what the English would call great power responsibility. And then the question becomes, is there enough social maturity in the bigger power of the European Union for the expression of that responsibility to be supported socially? So power politics today in Europe is all about the way in which the crisis has made this tension between the fundamental belief in the equality of member states, which is very important, it's not just the equality of citizens, it's individual citizens of smaller states feeling that their majorities as Greeks or Portuguese will not be overwhelmed by a majority of Europeans. They exist as national majorities and not just as individuals. So that is the question that is posed today in Europe, and that is really open. And the question, conversely, is whether big states, like obviously Germany, when they feel they have exercised their responsibility and hegemony by contributing to the sustainability of a common currency, exploit it by capturing that currency through overvalued exchange rate or overcompeting with the periphery, but also competing with the rest of the world in a way that the periphery can't. How is hegemony exercised in Europe? Now, that's one of the hinges for the resolution of the crisis. But when I speak of power in the EU, and I'm not going to say much to that, but every one of these aspects has an internal and an external aspect. And power, of course, this post-hegemonic agenda, is not only, and this post-imperial, the post-imperial condition of Europe, is not only an internal agenda, but it's, of course, an external agenda, too. And John spoke to this, but Simon was kind enough to speak of the fact that I just published this book, Echoes of Empire, and Dimo, who's here in the room, has a wonderful chapter there, where indeed we discuss at length the way in which the echoes of the empires that were not only those of the member states today, but empires around the world to which we can compare them, are still with us today, the present of the past. And that is fundamental because when we ask about power and the exercise of power today, there is of course a construct of Europe and the European project to move beyond its imperial past in the world, to be a regional power that doesn't try to dominate the world. But that comes with its nemesis. That comes from the fact that Europe is post-imperial not just in terms of transcendence, but in terms of reproduction. Imperialism is also in our DNA, not just internally, but also externally. And you can look at a lot of what's happening with Europe's role in the world today through these lenses. We have such a hard time managing this tension between denying that we are imperialist and having imperialist tendency, which explains in part what is happening in Ukraine. So that's for power, the unstable equilibrium of power. Next comes politics. Now, politics is really what this conference, in a way, is all about. But we can't understand the challenge of politics in Europe today if we don't understand all these other dimensions. And and politics, I would summarize the original bargain, which John again spoke to, as that whereby the founding saints, really what they wanted for Europe is to have domestic politicians but not domestic politics. And that meant have these domestic politicians get majorities once in a while but accept to be co-opted at the center without really being bothered by their citizens. And that we called for many decades the permissive consensus. Now, that's the permissive consensus. Elites were not very interested, but citizens were not that interested either. And indeed, you may recognize our dear Brecht, citizens had a tendency to say, well, you know, if we don't like the people, we can just re-elect the people. That's what happened with the French and Dutch no, and God knows I was for the yes, but elites did this once again, as Joachim reminded us. And of course, it's false to believe that there is some magic bullet for European democracy, including him. You know, so to say that suddenly because the president of the commission will be elected by the parliament, that that's the magic bullet for European democracy? No, no way. But citizens do ask, you know, why should we bother acting out our European citizenship in a polity where leaders never tire to re-elect us? So, you know, people reconcile themselves with the situation by saying, look, in a democracy, you have other sources of legitimacy, right? Purposive, the mission. And indeed, that's what this messianic notion that we have a mission. And when you have a mission, the ends justify the means. That was what Monet was all about. That's what most of our leaders are usually about. We have a mission. Whether or not the people follow us, we have a mission. But then, of course, you recognize that the mission loses its élan, especially nowadays. So for a long time, we've said, well, performative. It's the performance, stupid. The results, output legitimacy. But, you know, there's a real problem with output legitimacy. It's great when it happens, but when you don't have the output, what happens to the polity? In Britain, if our leaders mess up, we don't suddenly say Britain shouldn't exist. But in Europe, we're not there yet. And indeed, I think there's no better examples than the fickleness about the fickleness of output than, you know, Erasmus, where, yeah, there is lots of connection happening, but not the kind of connections with the European Union. It's not for nothing that the Commission calls Erasmus orgasmus secretly, but, you know. So Erasmus doesn't increase the legitimacy of the European Union. Connecting with the European Union is not necessarily connected with good output. And in any case, but there's much to say about the democratic challenge. If we had Simon Hicks or Sarah Herbold here, they would say much more. But the critical point to make here is that European democracy has to be grounded in the health of its national democracies. I describe it, and I won't spend time here with you today talking about it much, but as the fact that if we come back to our Rubicon, if we don't have a set of national democracies in Europe, or a European democracy like the federal state, because we haven't crossed the Rubicon, what we have is a democracy, a union of peoples, citizens and states. And that's the kind of Europe we have. And that democracy has supranational elements, but above all, it needs to be anchored in the respect and empowerment of national democracies. That's what it's all about. So, and yes, in part, it's a story about how, you know, every time European people demonstrate throughout Europe, somebody like Derrida and Habermas say, hey, this is Iraq. There is a European people that's born, or after the crisis, demonstrations all over, the birth of the European people. I'm not saying there is not a thin European demos, but the point is there may be one European demos, and there are 28 national demos, plus the regional ones, and that's what we need to engineer for European democracy to work. So democratization is to stay on the Rubicon, in spite of increased competences, more and more competences at the European level, and to respond to the demand for anchoring of democracy. So that's the story of democracy from my point of view. And one of the things that it involves, since the theme of this session is nationalism, is that we need to have a way in European politics to integrate groups that are nationalist one way or another. This is the Dutch, you know, Euro-nationalist, not Euro-nationalist. We need, though, of course, there are some red lines. There are those who are beyond the pale. They're the racist and anti-Semitic. Yes, maybe they don't have place in Europe policies. But all the movements that are more about Europe control, localization, role of national parliaments, part of reconnecting with European citizens in Europe today is to be able to listen to the parts of those movements that are more constructive, perhaps more moderate. That's also what democracy is about. Okay, so now time is running by, and I know I don't have my 45 minutes because we need to leave time for question. So I'll try to go faster and move on to the question of law. Well, Simon is here, so I don't need to say much about European law because he, like me, would agree that the first democrat in Europe was him. Yes, we can't. And that, you know, if he'd seen the European Union, he might have been bewildered by our questions about citizens. He was a proto-democrat. He was a federal, a cosmopolitan. But indeed, he had a system of law, of thinking about law, that is completely relevant to Europe today. And this is something I think about, and Simon has written beautifully about. And indeed, you can relate it to my, you know, democracy. Because Europe is about using law to organize what? Well, to organize a space for national law, that is the realm of the nation, through international law, how states agree among each other about who does what and who has what obligation. But the critical point is this arrow there, the cosmopolitan law, because cosmopolitan law is about organizing hospitality, what we call in Europe free movement. And that's what Kant thought through, and that's what the EU law is all about. And the question, the problem of law, then that was good. That was law at its best. The problem we have in Europe today is that law has taken on a new dimension, which you will understand very straightforwardly if you go back to YouTube and listen to Chablais after his big engueulade with Varoufakis and Syriza. And he says, he doesn't say, hey, we don't want to transfer union, we don't want to give money to these lazy Greeks. What he does say is, they don't respect the law. But what he's talking about is not European regulation and directives. It's a contract. It's law as a contract signed by the Troika, some semi-legal entity, and it's often signed by duress, because we know that condition is always contract plus coercion. And he calls that law. But it's a new kind of law. It's a kind of ordo-liberal law. It's a law that decides that you can have external governance and that you can dictate means through the law and not just ends. We can come back to this, but it's a very different notion of the law. And indeed, the problem with this law is that at the end of the day, it transforms a spirit where law was a mechanism for making commitments in Europe. Commitments. I commit from within to disciplines imposed from the outside. Maybe the same law, but it's a very different spirit. And we need to recover the spirit of law as commitment in Europe rather than law as disciplines. If you want to reconnect the citizens, especially of Southern Europe, that is critical, is to recover that spirit of the law, or else law will really have the bad name. Okay, so that's for the law. Now, that leads us directly to the question of jurisdiction, something that citizens really, really care about. Because, indeed, we were just talking about free movement. Well, what is the question of jurisdiction? Definitely the fact that Europe was based on a kind of contract that, yes, you could have free movement, but if the welfare state, our famous welfare state that John was talking about, was protected, that we had what we wanted, our social model. And what has happened, of course, with the crisis and the kind of push led by regionalization and at the continental level and globalization is that the kind of free movement we now have endangers the control of member states over their jurisdictional domain when it comes to the welfare state. And this tension has been fundamentally exacerbated. And it's very interesting to see that in this country, there is more resistance. We know that the resistance to free movement has as much to do about access to our welfare state as it has to taking our job. And it depends which region. But I still think it's puzzling that third country nationals, especially Commonwealth, are less perceived as threat to the welfare state than EU national, which supposedly would have a partial right of access to the British welfare state. We can ask why is that, and it's a long discussion. But to move on, economics. Now, on economics, there is much to say, but David Suskis will say it in a minute. The critical issue here, of course, is that we have managed to integrate diverse economies because all we had for a long time was diversities of regulation and laws that we integrated through regulatory mutual recognition. Now that the crisis demonstrates the extent to which we have diversities of capitalism, we realize that it's much more impossible to integrate those logics through a common currency. And there will be much more to say about Greece and its military-industrial complex, non-existent, deteriorating, and totally non-competitive. But the point is, again, the crisis has shown that citizens cannot both retain the diversities of their mode of more or less efficient capitalism, more or less socialized, more or less family-based, and live in a common currency. We have to choose? We'll come back to this with David. But to move on, then this leads us to our very last point, is the social. Now, the social, of course, is at the heart of our question of connecting with citizens. We used to call all that informal integration. The point is, the social is not just some objective material reality in Europe. The social in Europe is constructed. It's what people perceive that they are vis-à-vis each other. And we construct and reconstruct each other all the time. But the problem with the crisis is that we tend to, when we had made lots of progress through decades, in gaining mutual recognition, not just of our states, not just of our regulation and political system, but by the peoples, to understand each other better, to understand how we relate to history, how we relate to social obligations, etc. There was a deepening of mutual recognition in Europe. We seem to have lost this with the European crisis. And especially if you look at the conversation between Syriza, and I call this conversation, but discussion between Tsipras and Merkel. We've lost recognition. Germans in this story are not... Greece forget that Germans are not mean, even if some are. They're bitter and brainwashed. They're bitter to have to pay for their past by paying for others. And they're brainwashed by an elite that is telling them that this is so, and that the price to be extracted from others lies in singular solutions invented by them. And of course, Greeks, you know, hey guys, they're not lazy, although some are. They're burned and betrayed. You know, they're burned by the long shadow of a kind of past and recurring domination from the rest of Europe, and betrayed by a heroic tradition of resistance, which they misapply to the European Union. But we need to start to have our European people re-understand each other. And as I discussed with my late friend Ulrich Beck, there is a fundamental paradox in the EU today, which is as to why we have regrouped around national cliches and denials of recognition, where actually the crisis has led people to look at each other more than ever, to be interested in each other's elections more than ever, to fear them or want them or have empathy. So there is this kind of fascination for each other we've never had before, but it comes from negative politics. And it's not followed by transnational solidarity. A German worker fed up that actually his taxes are used to bail out his banks. That's what the euro crisis is all about. And therefore feeling some solidarity for the poor Greek worker that is left unemployed. No, we have a retrenchment around national cliches. So, and this is how it was translated, as you recall, 3 years ago at the height of the crisis between, you know, in the conversation, I do this with lots of quotes, between Greece and Germany. So, a lot in the crisis is lost in translation. That's where we are today. And including where the no from Greece comes from. It's all about history and 1943. So we're back to our transformative wheel. And of course, if I had time, I would talk about all the arrows connecting these categories, and especially they all come back to power at the end of the day. But I won't do this for lack of time. And instead, I will say that, yes, we are living with lots of forces and fusion that come from all of the spheres that I discussed with you today. It's not clear that we are going to stay on the Rubicon, that the wheel will come back into sync, and the kind of, if not harmonious, Luke, but at least the kind of equilibrium we've had for so many years. Will we stay on the Rubicon? A lot of people will say, well, yes, if we have a multi-tiered union and if we all go around and do different things. And I say, yes, we need a multi-tiered union. People are wise to say that. But we can't have a multi-tiered union where we have a very integrated federation on one hand and a disintegrated bits and pieces at the periphery around. Instead, we need to keep our unity and integrity as one European Union with multi-tiered elements in it. And if we do that, you know, we can remain on our transformative wheel. This transformative wheel can keep us on the Rubicon, and we can mobilize lots of forces, including the young people of LSE, of Oxford, who know how to use the internet, which is all about distributed intelligence, and therefore the kind of integration that I call for and I think might still yet save our poor continent. Thank you.
Now don't all go, because you can ask a question or two. We're going to... We have run over a little bit because of the earlier extension, but we're going to give ourselves 10 minutes and then there'll be 20 minutes outside for refreshments between these. I think there are microphones, is that right? Yeah. So if you've got a question, because we haven't got much time, we'll have questions now rather than lengthy contributions, if that's all right. I'll save them for another occasion. But we'll take one down here first. And answers brief as well, so we'll see if we can get through a few.
Thank you very much, Calypso, for that talk. I wanted to ask, do you think is part of what's complicating in democratic legitimacy terms the mission of mutual recognition that you were talking about, the delegation of so many decisions, both at national level and at EU level, to remote elite technocracies, to non-democratic quangos? I'm thinking about the fields of regulation, central banking, government services in general. Is part of the problem this delegation away from democratic politics to technocracies, as opposed to just the merging into the European Union of these functions?
Well, indeed, as you yourself, you know, research, and that's what I meant to say. When and John too, I imagine, when we say it's not just an elitist project, but it's also a technocratic project. And as Weber warned us long time ago, you know, technocracy is important. Expertise is important. Delegation to agencies is important. You know, we have complex bureaucratic machinery for a complex world, but they can become autonomous and there become the iron cage. What we have in Europe is Weber's iron cage in a bubble. So that's kind of even worse, and a kind of forgetting that the lesson from the U.S. that really inspired our founding fathers and those who created all these planning agencies and regulatory agencies is that at the end of the day, in the U.S., delegation and regulation is always anchored back into the politics. And in Europe, we have long forgotten to anchor back these technocratic delegation into democratic politics. So there are many ways of doing that, and I shouldn't say this so straightforwardly. I mean, I've written books and studied all the details of these policies. And of course, there are mechanisms, as we discussed earlier, mechanisms of accountability. Regulators don't run around all by themselves. National elected ministers look at what they're doing. But this is where one of the secrets of reconnecting to citizens is to make these delegation processes that are then mirrored by accountability processes much more transparent, much wider, much more visible, much more on the internet. There is much to do, and that not just vertically to the citizens, but horizontally, connecting parliaments, connecting national agencies together, and then anchoring them in their citizenry or NGOs. Citizens are not, of course, interested in everything. But that's definitely the agenda here.
Thank you very much. Can I ask a quick question to John, if you don't mind? You were talking about the legacy of empire and empire states in Europe. But one of the things that you didn't put much emphasis on was the Holy Roman Empire, which is kind of internal to Europe and, of course, Germanic. And I was given that one of Calypso's temptations was a German temptation to unity. I was wondering how much you think the sort of framework of European Union formation emerges out of that particular empire dimension.
Well, it's interesting that since the European project has gone on and the EU has developed, historical writing about the Holy Roman Empire has itself changed. There's been a reawakening of interest in it. You know, the standard cliche was not holy, not Roman, not empire, a waste of space. But it's now called a peace order or a legal order. And there's no doubt that, to think of the transformative will, some of the things that Calypso was talking about were very cleverly dealt with through their courts, the issues of jurisdictions. But what they were good at handling disputes between small members. Mm. What they were useless at was handling disputes between big members or disputes that involved outsiders. And after all, what finally got rid of the Holy Roman Empire? Napoleon. The issue they couldn't address, and I find it interesting, we talk about power, but one of the things we don't talk about much in the EU is military power. And yet, if you haven't got military power, in a sense, what does it mean to say that a state or any kind of order has power? So the Holy Roman Empire was fine so long as the stakes were small. But it seems to me as soon as the stakes were large, it didn't work.
Interesting.
Can I just add that, yeah. I mean, the Holy Roman Empire inspires a lot of people who write about Europe as empire itself as an empire, as a new continental empire. And I completely agree with what John said. But the other third, aside from the inability to deal with dispute or just power itself, let's not forget that this was an era, pre-democratic era. So the whole democratic challenge, that yes, small states were empowered and respected, although there were some asymmetries there, but there was also not a need, a necessity, a kind of survival necessity to, at the end of the day, be legitimate in the eyes of citizens because we were not in that era yet. So in that sense, the relevance has its limits.
Okay, well, we take one more there and then we'll have to have a break. Sorry, we've got no time. Yep.
Thank you. I have a question for each of you. So, Mr. Broly, can you please elaborate on the thought that you expressed on identities being produced rather than, you know, like which parts of European identity we inherit and which ones we can produce maybe through institutional mechanisms, etc. And to Ms. Nicolaides, I was very interested by the concept of democracies, but what is that, the implication for the cosmopolitan kind of idea in Kantian terms? Because I think that we can like interpret democracy into different ways. Like on the one hand, it's the problem that we now have at the European level, that we have different demos that, you know, can't interact with each other, can't find a common language, and the problem that we can't find an actual European demos. So, like, can you please elaborate on this kind of double meaning that I see in demo, both degrading and...
Thank you very much. briefly, both.
Being a historian, let me take an example. In the 10 years or so before 1914, you found two kinds of what we might call patriotism or nationalism in France. On the one hand, you had a nationalism that went on and on about identity. It was associated with the Dreyfus Affair, with Action Française. It constantly talked about what is the identity of France? What is the France that we must stand up for? And then you had the socialists. And the French socialists didn't talk very much about the identity of France. They talked about how could they make reforms, how could they democratize further, and so on. When it came to war in 1914, the crucial political force that took France with support into the war were the socialists, not Action Française. And the reason was because they were playing an important role in the way French politics worked, and their commitment to that politics came through the role that they played. So if you like, I prefer the word role to identity. It seems to me when we just talk about identity and we constantly go on, you know, what's our identity, what are our British values, what, and so on and so forth, we end up just, it seems to me, talking in circles and circles. When we talk about what do we do, and this is why I think perhaps the issue is not so much democracy in the sense of do we shift democracy from one level to another, but political engagement. If in the end MEPs had real power and therefore the number of people who wanted to vote for them went up and the number of people asking them what on earth they were doing went up, there would be a greater commitment, but it wouldn't come about through fostering identity, it would come about by fostering involvement.
Thank you. And Calypso,
okay. So I could talk about democracy for about 10 hours, but I see Simon would be very worried. And just to be very clear, okay, demoi is a plural, it's the peoples of Europe, but there is kratos. Kratos is very important. The point is, it's governing together, but not as one. We couldn't manage our interdependence, including democratic interdependence, if we didn't have the kratos, all these common institutions that help us govern together. But the point of democracy is that this governing together doesn't have to be based, it's exactly John's point right now, on a common identity, on a common demos, because we're not trying to have a European democracy, so we don't need a common demos. If we have some elements of Europeanness, European public sphere, that's not bad. We have that on top of our...